Before I begin this morning, I want to refer to something that several of you have asked me about, the thing I referred to only in passing yesterday about the passage in Nehemiah. They asked me where it was and actually what it said. And so I want to say just a couple of words about this and go home and look it up and get your pastor to study it. There are three neverthelesses in three verses there, which make a real good sermon out of it. You remember it starts, the 8th chapter, Nehemiah. I read that to you yesterday. It starts out that the people assembled in the street, and one version puts the forum before the water gate, and asked that the laws of God as given to Moses be read to them again. And so they read half the day and all the day and explained it distinctly so they'd get the understanding. Now, there's a passage over in 9 which applies to us. One of the prophets or priests is interceding with Jehovah for them because they, children of Israel like us, had gone astray. And the prophet said, the children of Israel took a fat land. That's what we did from the Indians. Did eat and were filled and became fat and delighted themselves in thy great goodness. Nevertheless, they were disobedient, rebelled against thee and cast thy law behind their backs and slew thy prophets or voted against them, you know, when the prophets warned, the prophets which testified against them to turn them to thee, and they wrought great provocations. And then a little later he goes on, nevertheless, for thy great mercy's sake, thou didst not utterly consume them nor forsake them, for thou art a gracious and merciful God. And then a little further down, after they were delivered, nevertheless, the people did evil again. Well, I'm sure the kind of divine forgiveness that came to the people of Israel when they got off the track is available to us if we'll do what they did in the 9th and 10th chapter. They made a sure covenant, or they said, and because of all this, we make a sure covenant to walk in God's law, which was given to Moses, the servant of God, and to observe and do all the commandments of the Lord our God and his judgments and his statutes. Well, I suspect that's what we in America need to do again, too. And it's so relevant, so current to our own particular problems. Now, I want to talk this morning about the general theme of where Christian action is. You hear all about get out where the action is. Where is the Christian action? I don't have to try to persuade you to become Christians. That's one of the advantages of coming to a place like this. You've all accepted Christ. Your commitment to him has been made. Your concern is, how can I be more effective in his service and as a witness for him? Well, from the beginning of the whole Christian movement, there have been two main views as to where the action is, as to what the principal task of the Christian church should be. And the controversy has been even more acute in some respects in some recent years. One view says that the main work of the Christian church is life-changing. Life-changing. That's where truly Christian action is. I heard Norman Vincent Peale say one day, and somebody said, what do you think the main church of the work of the church is? He says, life-changing. Just like that. Change men, and they will change society. Make men good, and they'll make society good. But others equally sincere say, but how can men become good when they're living in slums or without adequate food or health or decent living conditions and reasonably tolerable surroundings? Therefore, the Christian church's main task is to change society so as to make it possible for men to change their lives, to become good. You see, the action's in the life-changing. And the other is in changing society. One advocates what's called the personal gospel. Jesus' call, come, learn, follow. And the other puts the main emphasis on Jesus' command, go, the social gospel, so-called. One group tends to concentrate, sometimes almost exclusively, on helping individuals achieve mastery over themselves by turning themselves over to the master, that they almost forget society. Cambodia is in the news these days. I don't know whether you've been there or not. If you have, and if we ever may not in our lifetime again have a chance to get up there to see it. Angkor Wat. When the French took over Cambodia almost 100 years ago and followed around in the jungle, they found this temple up there. And when the airplane came along and they flew over, they found there are a lot of temples out there, all grown over with banyan trees in the jungle. They were built when the Khmer civilization, K-H-M-E-R, flourished. It was in the 11th, 12th, and up into the 13th century. And it was a combination of Buddhism grafted on Hinduism, as is easy to see from the symbols in the temple. It's one of the most, this Angkor Wat, the great one, is the most, one of the most remarkable structures I've ever seen created by man. These people became so concentrated, they concentrated so on achieving unity with God. Worship, that it got to the point that more than half of the males in that civilization were priests. They forgot to grow rice. The civilization went down because they were worshiping. Now the other group becomes so busy, sometimes almost exclusively, working to clear up the slums and abolish poverty and get better housing and better health and better education, that they neglect to worship and they fail to commune with God and in fellowship with their other, with other Christians. And so often you find them running out of gas. They become frustrated and they wind up in Washington trying to get goodness by the power of the state, coercion. One focuses on worship of God, the vertical, as someone has put it. The other focuses on service to man, the horizontal. One focuses on the inner man, and the other on the external surroundings. One on faith, what do we believe? And the other on works, what are we doing? And the conflict sometimes is bitter. But let's look at that now, these next few minutes. Are these two really in conflict? Or are they even separate? Or are they rather inseparable parts of one process? Not either one or the other, but both. Not two gospels, a personal gospel and a social gospel, but one gospel that includes both of them. Not Christian faith or Christian work, but Christian faith and Christian worker. I like the phrase Christian faith at work. Now perhaps we can get some guidance on this. Yes, perhaps the better word's instruction from the Bible, because that's kind of a good place to go. In both Luke and Luke 10 and in Matthew 22, you find a story about, as Matthew starts out, a certain lawyer asked Jesus a question, testing him. Now, if this is his purpose, he asked the right question. Get to the nubbin of the thing, the key. Which is the great commandment in the law? And you all recall, of course, Jesus' reply. He said, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and with all thy soul and with all thy mind. And Luke adds, and with all thy strength. This is the first and great commandment, your personal relationship to God. But Jesus didn't stop there. He never stops there. You ask him a question, he gives you a full answer. He gave this fellow more than the fellow asked for. He said, and the second is like unto it. Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. On these two, not one. On these two, he said, hang all the law. And then he didn't quit. The guy asked him about the great commandment in the law. On these two hang all the law and the prophets. Those great prophets of social righteousness, doing something about the community and the society. Well, he's saying if you don't have the first, if you don't love God, it's not easy to love your neighbor. And if you don't love your neighbor, you don't really love God. Well, Luke, yesterday I talked about the Ten Commandments, and today I'm going to talk about these two commandments that Jesus gave, the great ones. Luke says that the lawyer, seeking to justify himself, don't we always sort of divert a little attention, he asked, "But who is my neighbor?" And there he got more answer than he asked for. Jesus told him the story of the Good Samaritan. Now, there's one man in that story I've always been particularly intrigued with. The man I don't know anything about. The thieves, I know what kind of people they were. The priest, who was so busy, concerned, preoccupied with getting down to his priestly services, down at Jericho, coming down from the head up at Jerusalem, that he walked by on the other side. I know quite a bit about him. The Levite who went off and looked at the wounded man and still walked by. I know still more about him. And most of all, of course, I know about the Samaritan. But there's another man in the story, that first man. A certain man went down from Jerusalem to Jericho. Who was he? He belonged to the same race I do, the white race? That's very important. Yes, it is, but apparently not most important. He could have been a white man. He could have been a black man. He could have been a brown man at that crossroads of the world. Jesus didn't mention, apparently, that wasn't the most important thing. Well, what nation did he belong to? My nation? That's important, yes, but not most important. He could have been a Jew. He could have been a Samaritan. He could have been a Babylonian. He could have been a Syrian. He could have been a Greek or a Roman or a Spaniard or a North African or an Egyptian. Apparently, that wasn't the most important thing. Jesus didn't mention. Well, what class did he belong to? My class, white collar class, or working class? I don't know. Well, was he educated or was he an illiterate country bumpkin? I don't know. Apparently, those weren't the most important thing. Jesus didn't mention. I don't know anything about that except here was a man in need. And that was the answer. Everybody that's in need is my neighbor. The other things are important, but secondary. And then Jesus, following through, asked him a question. He said, "Which of these three, the priest, the Levite, or the Samaritan, thinkest thou was neighbor unto him who fell among the thieves?" And the lawyer said, "Why, he that showed mercy on him." And Jesus said, "Go and do thou likewise." Not just worship, go and do something about this situation. That is, Jesus not only showed this man who was his neighbor, but he showed him and he shows you and me what we have to do to be good neighbors. Complete answers. But you have to ask some questions. And the first question is, what in practical terms does it mean to be one's neighbor, a neighbor? Well, at least there are two ways. How does it mean to love a person as yourself? Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. Well, I think there are at least two ways. One is you must love him as a person. One of the deepest, maybe the deepest hunger of the human heart, we heard about it last night, is to know who you are and to be accepted, identified as a person, a human being. And wherever in this world there are persons today who've been discriminated against, who've been looked upon with condescension or even scorned or passed by on the other side, they are in revolt. They're determined to have better food, clothing, shelter, and all the rest of it, but they're after something else. It's an intangible. I would call it equality of status as a human being. And this revolt, gentlemen, will not be put down. It won't be turned back. This is not a matter of race. It isn't a matter of nationality. It isn't a matter of location, what continent or what country. It's a matter of persons. They're infected with what I would call the virus of the underdog, no matter of what race. Now, if you've got upper dogs and underdogs, doubtless it's justifiable once in a while to shift and let the underdog be the upper dog. But the Christian religion, its objective is to have mankind living in a way that won't be a dogfight. Not just who's upper, who's lower. Change this to a different kind of order. Confucius told a story 2,500 years ago. about a man who was an old man who was a refugee from an area where there was a famine, a drought. And he came tottering along to the edge of the famine area on the last stages of starvation and got to an area where there was food. And he went by a rice shop where the old boss, fat old fellow, was sitting there with a rice bowl and a chicken bone, chicken leg, and a jug of wine. And he said to the old man, "Go to, old man, help yourself." And the old man said, "Have I sunk so low I must take food given in disdain?" Tottered on, fell over, died. Now, a lot of Chinese didn't have a lot of possessions, but they all loved that story. They couldn't read and write, but they all knew that. They know what else. That's the thing that why I know Mao Zedong can't win, because it deprives people of dignity as individuals. We had a good program in India, aid program, and in Burma, doing what they wanted us to do. And they asked us to stop it after about 2 years. I was going out there with a congressional committee. Mr. Dulles said, "Walter, see if you can find out what went wrong. We were just trying to do what they said they wanted, which was in health and education. They didn't need food. They had their surpluses of rice. They didn't need highways. They had waterways they could use. The other countries might ask for. They didn't need irrigation and so on. They had the water. Food, education and health. They asked us to leave. I found out in 1 minute. I was talking to the Vice Prime Minister, who was educated in England. And he said, "You Americans are so aggressively friendly." There's the whole point, you see. We told them. We went and said, "This is what you're doing, man. You got brains enough to see how it ought to be done." And we showed them. He said, "If you weren't so sure of yourselves, if you didn't have all the answers on every question, if there were more places you needed us to help you, instead of you're always helping us, we'd be much more likely to go along with you." That is, they wanted these things, but not at the expense of being inferior. They just had gotten rid of the British who had controlled them. And now we walked in with aggressive friendliness and took over. We've done that all around the world. And we say, after all we've done, they help them and they don't like us. It was the way we did it. Not so much how much did we do, but how. The best story on how to do that's also in the New Testament. Jesus and his disciples were going through Samaria. You remember, you'll find this in the fourth chapter of John. And he sat at a well while his disciples went to the city to buy food. And a woman came out to draw water, you recall. Well, now, she had three strikes against her. First place, she was a woman in a part of the world where woman was subhuman. Second, she was a foreign woman. And she said to Jesus in the conversation, you Jews don't deal with us Samaritans. And third, she was a bad woman. Now, he could have said, "Lady, it's been a long time since I've seen anybody that needs a .4 program quite as badly as you. Isn't it lucky you ran into me this morning? Now, just listen carefully and I'll give you all the answers." And she would have frozen. Now, he didn't start out by telling her how much he had to do for her, but although he had plenty to do for her. He started out by asking her to help him. "Please, would you draw some water and give me a cup to drink?" She was important. She was recognized as a person. She had an identity. And she responded, of course. And in the next, she opened up her heart, and in the next few minutes, he was able to reveal to her some of the most profound things he said in his whole ministry. The virus of the underdog, if you wish. Mr. Churchill came to Washington right after Pearl Harbor and made a speech at a joint session of Congress, and he growled in his Churchillian way, "What kind of people do the Japanese think we are? Do they imagine we're the sort that'll be cowed into submission by this dastardly act? Don't they realize that we're the sort that'll be steeled into resistance until their evil conspiracy is weakened and overthrown?" And Mr. Churchill was right, and the Japanese militarists were wrong in their estimate of our character. But I thought I could hear somebody saying, maybe Mr. Gandhi, "Mr. Churchill, what kind of people did you think we are? We didn't invite you to come to India. You came in with your power. And you came and did so many good things. You gave us schools that our civilization had. given us. You established orphan asylums, and they had never been established in other civilization. And you took care of the lepers and the blind and the homeless and the destitute. And you took some of us to Oxford and Cambridge and gave us after you taught us to read and write English, you gave us the Bible and Shakespeare and Pilgrim's Progress and the political essays of Bacon and Burke and so on. You gave us ideas that are not in all of our Indian philosophies and religion. You showed us these things that are good. You convinced us that these are good and we want them. You taught us, and now you don't want us to have them. What kind of people did you think we are? And this is true not only in Asia, it's true in Europe. Toynbee said, the driving force that built the British labor movement was not low wages. It was exclusion from the employers' club. And it's true of the minorities here. And every once in a while I can hear some black person saying, what kind of people did you think we are? We didn't come here voluntarily as you folks did from Europe. We were brought here in chains as slaves. And after a while your consciences wouldn't let you do it. And you struck those shackles off our arms and legs. And you taught us to read a little bit. And you gave us Sunday schools and the Bible. And you gave us all these ideas. And now you're upset because we want what you taught us to want. What kind of people did you think we are? Now, my friends, this struggle means that we must be good enough to cooperate with these folks genuinely, to correct these discriminations or attitudes, condescensions, or else, be careful now, we've got to scrap our consciences and our decencies and try to suppress them with ruthless power. It means we've got to be better Christians than we've ever been, or no Christians at all. That's where we are. Love your neighbor as yourself means you've got to love him first as a person, another child of God. But also it means, I think, we must love him as a brother. The Talmud has a story. Goes something like, I saw an animal rummaging in a garbage heap, and I came closer and found it was a man. And I came still closer and found it was my brother. Gentlemen, can we in our worship pray, our Father who art in heaven, and then fail to recognize that every man is our brother? Or let me turn it around. Can there be brotherhood of man? Unless, first of all, we recognize the fatherhood of God. It's complete silly sentimentalism to talk about the brotherhood of man. There's lots of people who never darken the door of a church or read a word in the Bible and say they're atheists or agnostics and glibly go out to build the brotherhood of man. There ain't no such thing as the brotherhood of man. Unless, first of all, there is God and he's our Father. This is why, again, I say communism will fail, because in the long run, we may go down in the middle in the meantime, but it'll fail in the long run because it teaches people to hate God. And if you hate God, you wind up hating man. Karl Marx said hate is a more powerful motivation than love. Hate will prevail, so he taught people to hate. But Jesus said, thou shalt love the Lord thy God. Thou shalt love him. And if you really love God as Father, you must come to love your man as a brother, both as a person and as a brother. And if you begin with the first, you have to move on to the second. And if you go out try to love your brother, you're driven back to the first, or your battery runs down. And another question, how can one show one's love? How love effectively? Again, I think there are two ways. One, first, you can minister to the neighbor directly, to the person in need. That's what the Samaritan did. He went to him, poured oil in his wounds, put him on his beast, took him down to the inn, left him there, paid the bill, and said, if it isn't enough, I'll pay you the balance when I come back again. He did all he could for this man who was in need. And this is what Jesus did at the outset of his ministry. He went about doing good, healing, preaching. But that isn't all he did. He did more. You find in Luke 4, it says, he came to Nazareth, where he had been brought up. And he went into the synagogue on the Sabbath day, as was his custom, a layman in his home church, just like you and me. And he stood up to read, and there was delivered into his hand the book of the prophet Isaiah. And when he had opened the place, the book, he found the place where it is written, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he hath anointed me." That's what we come to conferences for, among other things, to become anointed. To do what? To preach the good news to the poor. Now, wasn't that a strange place to begin? You'd think you'd begin with somebody that was important, the governor, or the mayor, or the head of the bank, or the professor, president of the university. Somebody important. Begin with the poor. What can they do? Well, what would the poor regard as good news? The good news that they're interested in at the beginning is that they don't always have to remain poor. It isn't foreordained because I was born in this class of society. Forever I must remain here with no hope of a better life. That's not very good news. That isn't all the good news, but that's where it begins. That is, it isn't enough just to give alms to the poor. We have to do something about the conditions which make or keep people poor. And that means we have to be involved in economics, if you wish. He said, "He hath sent me to heal the brokenhearted, the failures, the ones who didn't make it. What can they do? How can you be influential beginning with them? Just comfort them? No, no. Do something about the conditions that break people's hearts. And that involves sociology. And that involves psychiatry, perhaps even." Then he said, "He sent me to proclaim deliverance to the captives." His people were captives. He didn't start a revolt against Rome. He was too practical. Another place he said, "If a man goes out with 10,000 men and the other fellow's got 20, don't start the war. Don't be a sap. You'll get clobbered. Be practical. There's such a thing as timing, maneuver. Don't start it until you've got enough to prevail." He didn't start a revolt. More people are captives in our world today than ever before in the history of mankind on this planet. This great enlightened 20th century. But did Jesus accept the fact that slavery was here? It's a fact. We've got to go along with it. We've got to recognize it and hobnob with it and so on. No. He said he'd come to proclaim deliverance. You weren't born to be slaves. You were born to be free. The universe is on the side of freedom. Hope on. As I said yesterday, we must never accept as permanent, as Jesus didn't, any regime that subjugates or crushes the human spirit. This means that we have to be involved in politics and international relations. The way things are done in our country is through government in the international field, and the way government's determined in our country is by what we do or don't do in politics. Then he said he'd come to give recovering of sight to the blind. This was medicine. This is my field. But surely he was not limited himself strictly to the physical eye. Surely he was concerned about giving sight to those people who were shut out from all that's ever been written down in scripture and prose and poetry and biography and history. The lives of other people, what's happened? Because they can't read. Medicine, education. Then he said he'd come to set at liberty them that are bruised. The ones who don't know how to manage their affairs. They can't get mastery over themselves. This was religion in the more usual sense in which we use the word. He was saying, I can set you free from those things that bruise you. You can go out of that door, and you and I can today. Never to be the same again. Never. That's part of the mission. What a program. What a program Jesus Christ accepted for himself out of the old prophets and called us to embrace. Not one or the other, both. That is, we must not only minister directly to the neighbor, we must minister to the neighborhood, the community. Now, the Samaritan, he wasn't a sociologist, he wasn't a criminologist, he wasn't even a citizen, he was a foreigner. He had no voice, he had no vote, he couldn't do anything about those thieves on the road. Perhaps he went on in part to get away before they came back. But you and I are citizens of this republic. We do have a voice. We do have a vote. We can do something about the thieves or the other things that are wrong. And we must. Now this leads to still another question. How do you minister to the neighborhood? And come back to what Jesus said again. He said four things. Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart. All thy heart. That is, you must care. You must care about God, and you must care about the world, and you must care about the people in it, and you must care about their problems beginning right next door. And you must be willing to, the word's empathy, identify yourself with people in their troubles. John Ruskin once said, there are 10 men who can think and 100 men who can talk for 1 man who can feel. Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart. Care. And he said, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy soul. All thy soul. That is, you must give yourself. Commitment. Give yourself to God and his world and the people in it and their problems. Commit. Decision. We talked about it last night. The crisis. Then he said, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy mind. You must think, study, work. How do you get to be a good doctor? You want some doctor to operate on you who's only spent a few minutes? Any surgical books? No. They're tough reading too. The price of capability and effectiveness as a witness is effort, work. You must think with all your mind about God and the world and his people and their problems. I spoke of one, and I mustn't spend any more time on it. I was going to a little bit, but we're late. This problem of peace. We've got to think about it. I said yesterday, people want peace, people want peace, people want peace. No people ever started a war. People want peace, and they pray for peace, and they march for peace, and still we don't have peace. Something wrong. We haven't been going about it the right way. Obviously, or within the last 5,000-6,000 years, we've been able to get peace. Why haven't we been able to get peace? Because if you analyze it and think, in almost every period of history, there's been somebody that wanted something else more than he wanted peace. Power, dominance, or freedom more than he wanted peace. And if you want something else more than you want peace, the other people who are got to resist. All this means that if you're going to get peace, Jesus said, be the blessed of the peace dreamers, the peace prayers, no, the peacemakers. And you got to have those forces that work that change lives on both sides. Change attitudes so that the things people want are not dominance at the expense of somebody else. On both sides of every conflict, every dispute, you've got to have these forces working that'll change men inside, their attitudes, their ambitions. And we got to think about that and work at it harder than we have. Then Jesus said, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy strength. That is, you got to work for God and his world and his people. Work at their problems as individuals and as organizations. Physicians or scientists generally work with diagrams a lot. And I think I said this 2 years ago, but I'll repeat it. My graph or diagram of the Christian church, the one that I think a lot of us have, if we at the beginning before we really think, is a circle with arrows coming in. We're out in our community to get people to come into the church. Arrows to come in. I don't think that's an adequate diagram. The diagram of the church, the fellowship that Jesus Christ established, was to get little arrows to come in, to be changed and charged and sent back out. Big arrows. Different. Not just to come in, but to come in for the life-changing, to go back out. To change society. Now, my friends, all these are not enough, are they? You can't really solve your neighbor's problems until both you and the neighbor become new persons. How do you become a new person? And now we're back at life-changing again. This involves a mystery, no question about it, and this involves a miracle. Yet, for 1900 years, persons just like us have been testifying that when they really opened their hearts to Jesus Christ and turned their lives over to His management, something happened. They were changed inside. They were released from an overpowering burden of guilt or inadequacy or fear or embarrassment. And they were energized to go out into society to change society. They didn't begin. It began with the life changing, but it didn't end there. That's the point. Now, when people say, we Christians got to be out where the action is, let's look for a moment. Where was the most important action in the century following the death of Jesus Christ, the crucifixion, the resurrection? It was something that happened in a man's heart on the road to Damascus. He was a vigorous man who was not only correct himself, he said as regards the righteousness of the law, found blameless. Who could say that among us? But that wasn't enough. All of a sudden he discovered it wasn't enough. And everything else was blocked out. He was blind to everything else except himself all of a sudden. What's wrong here? And, you know, he went to a weekend religious conference. And some wise layman counseled with him. He said, I see, let's be baptized and get on with it. And you and I are here as the Christians in the United States today because of what happened began with a man's heart on the road to Damascus. He took it over into Europe from where it was brought here. And here was another man. He was brought up a priest, a very devout priest, but he was tormented. And one day he saw something and he said, here I stand, God help me, I can do no other. And the whole Protestant movement came out of what happened in a man's heart. His life was changed and the world was changed. And here was another man. He was a missionary to the United States, very effective missionary. And then he went down to South Carolina and then he went back to England. But he was torn. And one night he went to a meeting in Aldersgate Church. And he afterwards described it and said, John Wesley, I found my heart strangely warmed. And John Wesley went out to that meeting and changed England. Out of what happened in that man's heart that night came the anti-slavery movement, came the anti-child labor movement, came the anti-sweatshop movement, the society changing. The action out there came from a beginning in a man's heart in Aldersgate Chapel. Stanley Jones has put this whole thing that I've been talking about better than any place else I know in two little sentences. He said, religion that doesn't start with an individual doesn't start. Religion that stops with the individual stops. Here we have two laws, just as yesterday we had 10 given to Moses. Two larger, more inclusive, more beginning more with inside by our Lord. Now we can violate these laws, same we can violate those laws we talked about yesterday, but we can't break them. If we violate them, if we fail to understand them, fail to dedicate, they break us. And we can go to our doom. But there the laws are available to us. Why should we cheat ourselves by failing to turn ourselves over completely, wholly, so that this can happen, this miracle, this mystery with us as the way to have it happen out in society? Unless we love God with all our heart and soul and mind and strength, my friends, you and I know we can't really love our neighbors ourselves, can we? And yet, unless we love our neighbors ourselves, we don't really love God. On these two hang all the law and the prophets. And surely on these two hang your hope and mine of finding victory and satisfaction in our personal lives. And surely on these two hangs our hope of dealing successfully, usefully, redemptively with our community, our country, our world. The action is in both. He hath sounded forth the trumpet that shall never call retreat. He is sifting out the hearts of men before His judgment seat. Now what? Oh, be swift, my soul, to answer Him. the person. Be jubilant, my feet. Go to work, the social. Our God is marching on. Let's march with him. Thank you.